My name is David Wee, and this presentation is entitled The Bases Are Full, or Baseball in American Culture. What I'd like to do tonight is not answer all the questions there are about baseball, but to talk a little bit about this sport, which we call the national pastime. Talk a little bit about what it is that makes Americans so fascinated with this sport, and to get your involvement in talking a little bit about your response to the sport and some of your ideas about why it is that we pay so much attention to baseball. My voice is a little rough tonight, so I want a lot of infield chatter here to kind of give me some support. Baseball as a part of our culture is only part of what I find to be a very strange but fascinating phenomenon, and that is our American passion for sports in general, and particularly professional sports. The rest of the country is giving at least some of its attention this weekend to the Super Bowl. I wonder why it is that we spend so much money, we pay such salaries to professional athletes, why some of us read the box scores in the paper with faithfulness during the baseball season. Now that we're in a time of war, it reminded me, thinking of the Middle East, did any of you remember what it was that was the gift of the nation to the 400 for the hostages that came back from Iran after their 400 and some days? Anybody remember that? They all received lifetime passes to Major League Baseball. You know, what would be more appropriate to American hostages than give them free pass to baseball for the rest of their life? Interesting. Kristen just told me a few minutes ago about a company in Iowa that she just learned about has sent how much?
I don't know just the quantity, but
huge quantities of expensive lighting standards over to the Middle East so our soldiers can play night baseball over there. It's too hot to play in the daytime in the desert, but baseball is the thing that they want to play to make them think about America and get their minds off some of the tasks facing them. So there are a lot of things about baseball that touch us in some odd and surprising ways, and I'd like to have us talk a little bit about that. I teach a course at St. Olaf College on baseball and American culture, and students who sign up for the course are always faced with all sorts of embarrassing questions back home about taking a college course on baseball. And you know, what do you do? Sit around and spit and talk about batting averages. Sport in American culture has become more and more of an academic subject, and now there are societies, professional societies of people like myself who teach courses on baseball and write articles on baseball. And it's becoming more and more a part of the academic scene at college. But people often ask me how it was that I got interested in baseball, and some of you may have been asked the same thing. And I can claim that it's genetic, which gives me a good excuse. I learned when I was adult that my grandfather, who was an immigrant from Norway, loved baseball. Now, he came to this country when he was 18, so he didn't grow up like many of us do playing sandlot baseball. There aren't many flat spots in Norway to do that anyway. But he came to this country and became a Lutheran minister and then a seminary professor and taught Old Testament and Hebrew at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And I didn't know him because he died when I was 3, but I've seen many pictures of him, and he was your image of the stern-faced, straight-backed, sober Norwegian pietist. And I thought, what in the world was this man doing fascinated by baseball? I learned from a couple of my religion professors at St. Olaf many years ago that when they were at the seminary in the late 30s and my grandfather was still teaching, that during the first week in October he canceled all of his afternoon Hebrew classes because he was in his study listening to the World Series on the radio. Did this every year. And the most outrageous story about him was that he had been sent to Persia, which is present-day Iran, by the church back in the early 20s to do some work for the church, and spent a year there. And back in those days, communications and travel were not as easy as they are now. The family didn't know exactly when he was going to come home. He came back by steamship and then train and then trolley car. My family lived on the seminary campus in St. Paul. And Dad says that one day the family was sitting down to Sunday dinner, and in walked Grandpa, just back from a year in Persia. And he walked in, kissed his wife, my grandmother, hugged the kids, sort of looked at the piles of mail that were gathered on the buffet, stood around filing absently through them, and my grandmother said, "Well, aren't you going to take off your coat and sit down and eat with us?" And he said, "Well, on the streetcar on the way up here, I noticed that this afternoon there's a doubleheader between the Millers and the Saints down at Lexington Park, and I'd like to go." He walked out of the house and went to a doubleheader. So,
oh my gosh.
If my grandfather can be like that, I figure that it's okay. It's understandable, at least for me, to have an inordinate passion for this game. As you can see, I wore the closest thing I've got to a baseball uniform, including the batter's shin guard. So I think this is why I like knickers. I was never a good baseball player, but this is as close as I can get to wearing the uniform. When people start to ask about baseball, they wonder about what we do in the class and what we read. And I put some of the books on the board here, and I'm going to erase them soon so that we can do something else there. But just to tell you a little bit of what we read in this baseball class, which uses a lot of American fiction. There's been excellent American fiction about baseball and not very much good American literature about other of our sports. It seems to attract the best of our writers. The top five books, I would consider the best American novels about baseball, if you were going to read one. Mark Harris, who wrote The Southpaw and Bang the Drum Slowly. Now, some of you may have seen that movie. Have any of you seen it? It was one of Robert De Niro's earliest films. He does a brilliant job of playing one of the main characters in it. W.P. Kinsella wrote Shoeless Joe, and that's the movie that Field of Dreams is, that's the novel that Field of Dreams is based on, which we'll be watching about an hour from now. Wonderful novel, better than the movie, as most novels are. Eric Greenberg wrote one called The Celebrant, which is about being a fan, about being a lover of baseball, and the main character in it is much more than just a fan, more than somebody who likes to go to games. He is a celebrant of Christy Mathewson, who is one of the great pitchers at the turn of the century. And I learned from Dad that one reason Grandpa liked baseball so much was Christy Mathewson, a great pitcher for the New York Giants, who after graduating from college went right into the major leagues and promised his mother that he would never play baseball on Sunday. And somehow that touched my grandfather such that, you know, this young man would hold his religion more important than
than baseball, that he became enchanted with Christy Mathewson and baseball. Some of you have seen the movie The Natural, starring Robert Redford. That was the first novel of Bernard Malamud, who's one of our important American novelists. The movie, in this case, I think, is much more fun than the novel, which is a very dark and dismal novel that ends in a different way from the way the movie ends. Ring Lardner, back in the 20s, one of our important American journalists, wrote one called You Know Me, Al, which is absolutely hilarious, about a young, brash pitcher who's very good, but much dumber than he is good. And he has all sorts of jokes played on him. He tries to impress people with his ball-playing ability. And then, of course, the one novel in our literature that is entitled The Great American Novel is, of course, about baseball. And this is an outrageous novel by Philip Roth, who became famous for Portnoy's Complaint and other novels based on the Jewish experience in America. This is hilarious and outrageous and disgusting all at the same time. And it's a wonderful novel for English majors because it has all sorts of parodies of famous novelists in our culture and all sorts of inside jokes about literature that you only get if you have read a lot of literature. Then a few other books to recommend if you have a friend who loves baseball and you're thinking of birthday gifts or Christmas presents, or if you want them for yourself. Two of the best writers in our country right now about baseball are Roger Angel and Thomas Boswell. Roger Angel covers baseball for the New Yorker magazine. He has one of the great jobs in American life. Basically, he's to write one good article a year for the New Yorker that covers the World Series of the previous fall, plus some other things about the season. He does write some other things too, but mainly baseball. Any of his books are just wonderful. He's a brilliant writer, user of the English language, as well as a most perceptive interpreter of the game. And every 5 years, a new book comes out that includes those New Yorker articles from the last 5 years, plus a few other articles that he's written. Thomas Boswell covers baseball for the Baltimore Sun. Is that the name of the newspaper in Baltimore?
Mm-hmm.
And he too has written several collections of his baseball pieces called How Life Imitates the World Series, one title. And another one is called Why Life Begins on Opening Day. Titles that go right to the heart of those of us who love baseball. If you're interested in an analysis of the role of professional sports, not just baseball, but football and basketball, boxing as well, I recommend this book by Michael Novak called The Joy of Sports. Michael Novak is a prominent American theologian, philosopher, economist, and he is absolutely crazy about sports. He has brilliant chapters in here about all of these sports, and explains in a very effective way how it is that we get wrapped up in it, and talks about, in many theological terms, about baseball and how and why it touches us. A man named Daniel Okrent has written a book called Nine Innings, which is a whole 300-page book describing a single baseball game. And as he goes through this game in 1986, I think, between the Baltimore Orioles and the Milwaukee Brewers, just an unimportant middle-of-the-season game, he explains all sorts of inside, behind-the-scenes things about baseball, such as what's going through the mind of the batter as he steps out of the batter's box, knocks the dirt out of his cleats, and tries to outguess the pitcher on whether the next pitch will be a curve or a fastball. All sorts of things that most of us in the stands don't know anything about, but are part of the great complexity of this game. And then the ultimate baseball book is a coffee table book, big, full of lots of pictures, sections of writing by some excellent American and Canadian writers, following the history of baseball decade by decade, so that you get an overview of the history of the sport and lots of good pictures. And in my course, I also use movies. Hollywood has made a lot of movies about baseball. We've actually come into just a wonderful era of that in the last few years. They didn't come out quite so frequently before. One of my favorites is called It Happens Every Spring. This dates from about 1940. It's about a college English professor who every spring sort of starts to get spacey in the classroom. People find out that down underneath the lectern, he's got the radio and he's listening to the St. Louis Cardinals, his team, you know, playing baseball games as he's giving lecture. He's quite distracted at times. And you know, wishes that he could be a great player, and he hears the announcer saying, you know, what the Cardinals need this year is just one more good pitcher and maybe we could win the pennant. Well, he happens to be working, he's a chemist, and he's doing research on termite control. And some students are playing baseball out in the campus lawn, and one of them hits a home run, goes right through his laboratory window and smashes into his experiment that he's been working on for months. And he picks his dripping baseball out of the sink, and his experiment has been ruined. And he rolls the ball down, and it hops right over a log that he's got there on the laboratory table. And he, being a true baseball fan, he puts two and two together, bottles up supply of this, and finds that nobody can hit his pitch. And he goes and tries out with the Cardinals. And there are dreams all over in baseball. Damn Yankees is a marvelous movie and musical. The movie stars Gwen Verdon. It's a dance piece, and it's really the Faust legend, ancient Germanic legend put into baseball terms, where a lover of the Washington Senators, who were described as a Washington at the time, the Senators were always last place. Washington was described as first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. And they are again losing to the Yankees, and he says, "I'd give anything to be a ball player." The devil appears and says, "Anything?" And he has to sell his soul, but he becomes a baseball star. His youth is renewed, and his team wins the pennant, of course. So these are some of the texts that in movies, in books, that are really central to this topic in American culture. Now, I have to tell you that when I first came to Holden, we were driving across the country from Minnesota. I'd never been out here before. My wife grew up in South Dakota. We came through Pierre, the state capital in the center of the state, and headed west. Went through the little tiny town of Hayes, 30 miles west of Pierre. And then we were out in the country where they filmed Dances with Wolves. And it still looks like that. You know, nothing out there, absolutely nothing. Another 5 miles west of this little town, the road took a turn south, and I looked, and here were these huge light standards. There's a huge baseball field, you know, out there in the middle of absolutely nothing. Karen told me that it was a baseball field, that her dad used to play baseball out there. He was a great big farmer, weighed 250, 300 pounds, built sort of like Boom Boom Balboni on the Yankees. They used to play baseball out there, and he'd just throw himself into baseball, donkey baseball, regular baseball, softball. When he was governor of South Dakota, go out there and play ball with legislators out in Nowheresville. And I thought, you know, if there are baseball parks in places like this, you know, cowboys out there playing baseball, it's got to be an important part of American culture. Then I came up, we arrived at Holden. First day we got here, I took a walk about a half mile up the road. What did I find? The ballpark. The only flat spot, probably within dozens of miles around here. What the miners did was build a baseball diamond out there. And in the summertime, can you still see the crumbling boards of the bleachers out there along the first baseline? It's all under the snow right now, but they used to have huge crowds out there watching themselves playing baseball right here at Holden Village. So it made me realize that there's something about cowboys, miners, city kids, farm kids, everyone who gets into baseball. And I wanted to find out, I'm interested in finding out, you know, what it is that makes us like it. And I'd like your ideas on that. And for those of you who don't like baseball, you know, the truth squad out here needs to check the rest of us who don't understand you to try to explain why you don't like it. Many people find baseball boring, for instance. Those of us who love it, you know, find it so intense that even between innings, you know, we are paying attention to what's happening, and it fills our attention every second of the game. And others who don't know the game or don't like it, you know, are talking to each other, and the rest of us can't stand it. To be interrupted and talk. And part of the fascination for many of us is the complexity, the kind of thinking that we're doing there, trying to outguess what's going to happen on the field, trying to anticipate, trying to notice whether the shortstop moves over one step and in a step when the batter comes up, whether the pitcher is throwing a changeup and therefore the batter is shifting his stance and so forth. All those little things get noticed by the people who are really loving baseball. In the course, we talk about all sorts of things, not just the history of baseball, although we do some of that. We talk about numbers and statistics and why the fascination with statistics. But we talk about economics, talk about sociology, talk about religion. We talk about the metaphysics of baseball, the aesthetics, the beauty of it, and the literature of it, the way it gets into our language, and we'll do a little bit of that tonight if we can. This is going to be sort of the seven-inning game version of baseball presentation so that we can get to the snack bar and get to the movie. But a few things about baseball that I think are interesting to consider, especially in comparison with other ball games. And this is what we might call the metaphysics of baseball. How does it differ from, say, football in a metaphysical sense? Consider the fact that most ball games consist of the strategy of trying to get yourself into enemy territory, right? Your job in football, basketball, hockey, soccer, is to try to defend your home turf and try to invade somebody else's turf. It's a very militaristic kind of thing when you come to think of it. You try to get into the end zone in football of somebody else, and your job is to try to knock people down. You try to defend your country or your turf and against this strong push to knock you over and carry a ball across your border into your country. And when that happens, you lose. The man who invented basketball, James Naismith, was trying to invent a game, one of these territorial games,
that where there couldn't possibly be body contact. And his thought was, see, if most ball games, you've got a vertical plane that we can't see, but an imaginary plane, a boundary line with a plane above it, and the job is to get the ball across that plane, and that's the way you score, either carrying it, kicking it, hitting it with a hockey stick. You know, that's what you try to do. He said, if we take that boundary, that plane, and turn it horizontal and raise it 10 feet above the ground, there's no way that you can put your body, you know, in front of that boundary, and therefore cause all this injurious body contact that we have in football and soccer and so forth. He didn't anticipate what would happen in genetics and nutrition and so forth, leading to 7.5-foot players. And I think he'd be stunned to see how the game is played now. But you know, his idea was that you just gently loft the ball up in the air, and then it falls through that plane, which is now flat and 10 feet in the air, and you can't get your body in front of the ball. So it'll be a gentle game. How things change. But perhaps the thing I'd like to have us think about now in the 15 or 20 minutes we've got left has been the way in which baseball is, and other professional sports, are a kind of religion with many people in this culture. And I think what I'll do is erase things here and just ask us together to think of how many kind of parallel things, how many things are shared by professional sports and religion. How many analogies are there between what we do when we go to a professional football game or the World Series and things we do when we worship? And it's a little embarrassing and stunning when we do this. Somebody want to start out?
Pray.
We pray? Okay, well, it's true. Some of us do. Okay.
Go with family.
Okay, it's a family event.
Days of the week they're played.
Okay, there are
Sunday games.
Special days, football in particular is Sunday, but there are sort of holy days, you might say, especially football, professional football.
Praise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are.
Everyone praising, like cheering the team.
Yeah. The way we cheer on our teams with.
We have an opening hymn.
Okay. The opening hymn. First time I talked at Holden about baseball, and Dave remembers this because he was here years and years ago. I came in, sat down. It was all set to begin in a very formal way. Everybody stood up and sang the Star Spangled Banner. Okay.
There's like performers and an audience, congregation.
Okay, there are, okay, we'll say performers and audience.
The players strive for perfection.
Okay,
practice.
Seeking perfection.
There are uniforms involved.
Okay, there are certain vestments that people wear.
Certain rituals are repeated.
Okay, rituals. Can you think of any in particular?
Coin toss.
Okay, some of them have a coin toss at the beginning of the game.
Rally caps.
Rally caps. Do you all know about rally caps?
No, I don't know.
Show us a rally cap, Dane and Mike.
Very impressive.
There's kind of a communion wine and bread in the perennial.
Hot dog. First, the rally cap ritual. Players, when they in baseball, when they think a rally is happening, you'll notice sometimes camera will zero in on the dugout. You'll see the players with their caps turned inside out and upside down.
on their heads, and that's a sign that good luck that they're going to have a rally. It's kind of a ritual. Okay, we've got the
sacraments.
Okay.
There's lots of signals happening.
Okay.
Which, if you signals? Ever preach, you know what it means to be.
Signals, right.
Thank you.
The organ, well, there's an organist,
oh,
too.
Sure,
right?
I was going to say
the organist and the preacher are signaling to each other, but yeah. We've got an organist.
One of the rituals for the Cubs is that, what is it, the seventh inning? We all stand up and sing.
Okay.
There's an order, it's like a liturgy.
Okay. There's kind of
one person has the final judgment call.
Okay, there's yeah, we could say well, there's a high priest or that kind of okay.
We put a lot of hope in the outcome of the game. There's a lot of hope that we will win.
An eschatology operating with both of these.
Eschatology. Played by the book.
Okay. We play by the book.
The battle between good and evil.
Okay, good versus evil. Most of us see it that way.
Ushers.
Bulletins.
You enter at the gate.
Pardon?
You enter at the gate.
Team spirit? Okay. Didn't hear that one.
I don't know.
Standing on spirit.
Okay.
I don't know anything about baseball at all, but is there eternal life in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah. In the book called The Southpaw and Bang the Drum Slowly, the main character keeps referring to Hall of Fame players as immortals. And we still do, you know. Someone is immortalized. You know, Rod Carew, the Minnesota Twins, is now an immortal in baseball, too.
Have heroes and saints.
Okay, right. Heroes and saints. And again, these are the Hall of Fame people who are... Where? I mean, they're in the shrine. I've been there. Anybody been to see the baseball shrine? Carl has? Mike? I mean, it's a very holy-like place, isn't it? I mean, it's like a temple there. It's really really interesting. So we've got the shrine.
It's on TV.
Televised.
Them, maybe that's in the good and evil.
Yeah, the us versus them. Okay.
There are different teams, so different denominations.
Yeah, maybe. There are different sort of sects and
minor leagues.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who can't stand the American League because of the designated hitter rule. And they're National League fanatics. You know, this is like the difference between the Missouri Senate and the rest of us. Yeah, schisms. Okay.
I picture passing the plate, you know, when you're passing money down to your frosting, which is why I go to baseball games.
Right.
passing
the beer money down. Somebody told me once when we were doing this, they said, well, in both there's penance. Someone right here at Holden Village said that. Okay. There's a kind of morality stealing is part of that. Okay, yeah, there are congregations like the Bleacher Bums at Wrigley Field. You know, they know each other. They're go together, and the season ticket holders always sit together. So there are congregations.
There are one or two very sacred objects.
All right, the sacred objects.
Boston baseball.
I mean, how many of you have ever wanted to catch a foul ball and or get it autographed by a player? And I've got several autographed baseballs in my study at home. So there are the.
We have holy space up there. Surely these fields, these good. Are sort of holy space.
We've got the cathedrals, right? Mm-hmm. And what about the time, say, for professional football? When do the games start? Noon on Sunday? You know, it's the, you know, even sacred times. Maybe we talked about that already. Any other things? I mean, it's amazing that this is a kind of secular religion with us. And it's understandable how some of us get caught up in it, in a kind of religious fervor. Those of us who had the good fortune to be in Minnesota 3 years ago when the Twins won the pennant in the World Series, you know, and you know, most of us were waving our Homer hankies fanatically, and it has become a kind of this is a sacred object, but I'll send it around so you can look at it.
Don't put your nose in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now we're talking about the sacred language. And let's, well, we don't need to write this down, but there is a language, a vocabulary that is used in the ballpark and in the dugout. And what's interesting is how much baseball language and metaphors has worked its way into our everyday vocabulary. Now, let's toss around a few of the terms that you've said yourself in the last week or two.
They said the other night on the radio, we're pitching a no-hitter.
Okay. Pitching a no-hitter. We all know.
About the war. Yeah.
Yep.
Strikeout.
To strike out. Okay. To be born with two strikes against you.
Batting zero.
Batting zero. Okay. To pinch hit. Okay, out in left field. You think of any others?
Shortstop something.
Okay.
Make your pitch.
Shortstop to make a pitch.
Field question.
Field question.
Threw a curveball.
Yeah. Got thrown a curveball. Okay. I'll read a few of them right here in a row, just to from a book. This is another marvelous book about baseball called Willie's Time. It's about Willie Mays, and unfortunately this book is out of print, or I'd use it in my class next semester. Willie Mays was one of the most remarkable ball players of all time. And this book, interestingly enough, about Willie Mays, its chapters are entitled Harry, Ike, JFK, LBJ, and Nixon. And Willie Mays played
during the terms of all of those presidents. And while all of those changes were going on in our culture, Willie Mays was one of the steady things. One of my favorite lines from this book is this one. And this is, again, pointing out how steady some things are in baseball and unsteady they are in the culture. Now listen carefully. In 1951, Richard Nixon said it was akin to treason for anyone to advocate the admission of Red China to the United Nations. In 1951, World Series, Willie Mays played center field for the New York team of the National League. In 1973, 22 years later, Richard Nixon expressed his self-congratulation for getting Red China admitted to the United Nations. In 1973 World Series, Willie Mays played center field for the New York team of the National League. Some things always change and some things don't change at all. But here are some of the, just a quick list of some of the terms. Somebody who never got to first base, someone who's out of his league, out in left field, someone who never took the bat off his shoulder, someone who doesn't know his rear end from third base. I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, you understand?
Was it second
base? Someone who got caught off base. I want my last licks. The game isn't over till the last man is out. Get in there and pitch. Games that are called on account of this or on account of that. Warming up in the bullpen, touched all the bases. And one of my favorite lines here is somebody described somebody he didn't like very well, saying he reached puberty but he forgot to touch second. To be a bench warmer, a squeeze play, curveball, a high hard one. A circus play, a grandstand play, the bleachers, the home park, extra innings. It goes on and on and on. Terms that you and I have sort of adopted into our vocabulary, and most of us understand them, and most of them come straight from baseball. So as a teacher of language and as a teacher of literature, it's very interesting to me how what an impact baseball has in our culture. But it's not just in the kind of aesthetics, the beauty of the game, the fascination we have with the metaphors of the game, but some of the things that it has done in a sociological sense. I'm also ashamed of some of the things that have happened in the economics about baseball. And they're just appalling. But one of my favorite anecdotes about baseball has to do with Jackie Robinson. And you all know about Jackie Robinson being the first black ball player admitted to the major leagues to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. And this was a very carefully orchestrated thing. He was hand-picked by the owner of the Dodgers to be the right person at the right time to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball. But it was a tough... You know, there was a lot of opposition back in 1947 to having blacks playing with whites. And the only southern team, the only team in the National League in a southern state back then was the St. Louis Cardinals in Missouri. And the first road trip that the Dodgers made with Jackie Robinson on the team to St. Louis, the St. Louis players decided that... they were not going to play. They were going to strike in protest to having a black man playing on the field. And Ford Frick, who was the president of the National League and later the commissioner of baseball, and this shows kind of the political power that exists in baseball, he sent a message to the St. Louis players and said, if you don't take the field and play against Brooklyn, none of you will ever play another baseball game in your life, in the professional game. They all went out and played. And, you know, very, very shortly, the problem of having blacks playing in this national game was overcome, and, you know, now many, many of the stars are black players. This was before the military was integrated, before countless other things had been integrated. And the fact that this sport was able to achieve that at that time in our culture, you know, 15 years before the civil rights movement really began to gain momentum, was a very important thing. I count that as a real achievement of some people in this sport to bring about some right kind of change in our recent American history. Well, those are just a few of the things that make me fascinated with baseball and with professional sports. And I thank you for joining in on this. We're going to watch a delightful movie. How many of you have not seen Field of Dreams? Okay, many of you have. It's one of those I could watch once a year at least, I think. The movie, as well as the novel, is set in Iowa and has a lot of actual historical information in it. One thing that many of the writers of baseball novels do is to take actual people from baseball history, including in this movie and book, one person who played only one half of one inning in his major league career, and Kinsella, the novelist, picked that out. He was just paging through the Baseball Encyclopedia, which is the most important book I have on my desk at home, and found this person whose name was Moonlight Graham, and worked him into the story, and a lot of other things about it are close to life. Well, a lot of other things we could talk about, but that is a start. Thank you for your attention, and let's go have some treats.